You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
Earlier this week, the folks over at Apple said they had a huge announcement. An announcement, they said, that would change everything. They said you'd never forget Tuesday, November 16th, 2010. The announcement? The Beatles were coming to iTunes. In theory, this should have been revolutionary. The band that launched the British invasion now finally invading the interwebs? But the tech press took Apple to task for overhyping. All of the Beatles' music was widely available on the internet well before the iTunes announcement, said Scott Bradner of PC World. Not legally, but widely available nonetheless. The bigger magical mystery question is what made the Beatles wait so long in the first place, especially when the market for digital downloads has never been better. Was it industry tension? Piracy issues? Just basic foot dragging? Or strategically waiting for marketing windows? The story itself may have been overhyped, but it does say something about the state of the music industry in the digital age. Digital distribution is the trend, if not becoming the default. We take for granted that music will be available digitally on iTunes in the first place, or on Amazon, or Pandora, YouTube, Spotify, Grooveshark, Pirate Bay, or one of the thousands of other avenues by which we can get music legally or illegally, often for next to nothing, immediately on the web. The Beatles' iTunes non-story is just another small footnote in the explosion that has occurred over the last couple decades in the music industry. There's many other bigger chapters to this story. It's the story of a convergence between industry, artists, and political interests, as well as consumers. And this is the story participants plan to explore next spring at the Rethink Music Conference in Boston. The subtitle for this conference is Creativity, Commerce, and Policy in the 21st Century, and you can expect panels, lectures, and even some live performances from artists. But organizers also just announced a pair of competitions. One looking for new business models for music, and one for proposals recommending changes to public policy or intellectual property law related to music. Entrants to these competitions have a chance at a cash prize and a chance to present at the conference in April. Our two guests on Radio Berkman today are two of the minds behind the Rethink Music Conference, Alan Bargfried of the Berklee College of Music and Chris Babbitts of the Berkman Center. Alan, why don't you tell me what the Rethink Music Conference is all about?
It's meant to be kind of a major music industry policy and business model conference. The idea came about around a year ago. Berklee started talking about trying to do something that was solutions oriented and get people in a room and really talk about what is the future as opposed to what has been in the past, or maybe even what is arguing about what is now, but what are the roads to the future. And we kind of teamed up with the Berkman Center for a collaboration starting in January. I think we've been working together on this now. And it's going to be a two-day event here in Boston at Heinz Convention Center. It will have evening entertainment by major artists. It will have panels, keynotes, interviews, a number of discussions revolving around the music industry. And there is a business model competition where we're awarding $50,000 to the best new business model. And there's also a public policy competition that's being run by Berkman, where the winner will end up with a publication in the Journal of Entertainment and Sports Law.
Let's rewind just a little bit. Why did you feel, when you were first meeting a year ago, that this was something that needed to happen, that you needed to get a whole bunch of people in the room from, you know, the artist community, from the legal community, from the business community to talk about the future of music?
I think that there are a number of these events that take place every year that are not necessarily grounded in academic thought. They're not necessarily grounded with the idea of giving some thought to the artist and the creator and the people who are actually making the music, and how do we make creativity thrive in the 21st century. And so I think that's where we kind of got started. Was Berklee as a conservatory, and we have over 4,000 musicians attending there, and we want to help our student body as well as the musician community as a whole really be able to survive and thrive as musicians. And so I think that was kind of the initial thought was, let's do something that's solution-based. Let's do something that's different from all of the other industry conferences that exist. Let's do something with an academic edge to it, with some really high-level thought. And let's do something that gets the artists involved.
I think a lot of those are the things that appealed to us at the Berkman Center when we were first approached by Berkeley about getting involved in this, and particularly on our end, getting involved with this policy proposal competition where we're going to be putting out shortly this call for papers, asking people to identify a particular aspect of U.S. law that they find doesn't adequately support creativity, creation of musical works, distribution of musical works, and then propose a solution to that problem. Berkeley throughout the process has been advocating, as Alan has said, this to be a solutions-oriented event. We are hoping that these policy proposals are actually going to be implementable, that they're going to be finite, that they're going to be discrete, that they're going to allow people to not talk in generalities, but say, if we did X, that would improve life for musicians and for consumers and creators and people who love music. And the same thing with the business model competition that Berkeley's talked about. So I think that those aspects of this struck us as something that was probably a little bit different from the norm. And that's one of the reasons we were excited to get involved.
Yeah, that strikes me as a very attractive part of this the idea of this conference is that, you know, you're actually bringing people together who are, you know, not just sort of wandering through the issues in kind of a haphazard way and discussing and arguing, but we're looking at problems that people have with the policy, problems that people have with the business model, and saying, you know, come forward and show us the solutions.
Right. And I think that the breadth of stakeholders who are going to be at the table here, if all goes well, is going to be really unique and really interesting as well. This is going to, we hope, have significant artist involvement. It's going to have significant involvement from the academic community. As Alan mentioned, we've been working with the Harvard Law School Journal of Sports and Entertainment Law, who's going to take a look at publishing perhaps one or two of the winning policy proposals that come out of the competition. We're going to have people from the business community. We're going to have people from content owners. We're going to have people from technology startups. I think it's going to be a really interesting and very broad mix of people who have a stake in the questions we're going to be talking about. And I think having all those stakeholders at the table will increase the likelihood that productive things will come out of the event.
You know, to take a step back from that, initially, it's important to keep in mind that the business model is really tied to the public policy, right? So everything that all of the business models have to flow within the confines of currently existing U.S. copyright law. In general, we're looking for submissions that can improve or provide a new method for creators to survive in the music community. So we're looking for mechanisms for stimulating and monetizing creativity in the music industry. So that could be a new touring model. That could be a new, to use a buzzword of a couple of years ago at this point, 360 model. It could be a recorded music model. There's a number of things. So I think we've opened it up, and it's a global competition. Anyone can enter. We're really hoping we get some creative submissions. And I think we'll get submissions from people who are artists. And I think we'll get submissions from business school students. And I think we'll get submissions from academics. And I think we'll get kind of a wide range of thoughtful submissions coming from a number of different perspectives.
I'm about to ask a really stupid question, but so it seems to me that the old business model, or the way that people survived, musicians survived, was that they would sell their records and they'd make a ton of money off that, maybe a little bit more off of, you know, other kinds of merchandising and touring and things like that. And that has kind of taken the wayside, but now musicians are learning the recordings aren't making as much money, but they have to tour and they're making a ton of money on the tour. And that's the new solution. I thought we had this problem fixed and we figured this all out. Is that completely wrong?
Well, but I do think that there's a question about monetizing the content itself. So, you know, to what degree do artists need to be able to monetize the content? If an artist records an album and puts blood, sweat, and tears and a year of his life into recording this album, you know, should there be some way for him to monetize it? Beyond the old model, which was the sale of CDs. And I think it's also important to look back and say, you know, that was the old model, but not all artists made money. I mean, the end artist making money from the record deal was certainly not a 100% number. I mean, there were many artists who never saw anything beyond the initial advance check from the record label.
I think your original question about sort of what is the right business model or what is the right policy fix to make things right here, I think the answer to that is depends on who you ask, because everyone has a different conception. I think you're right. I think there is a perception that the value of recordings is going down, the importance of touring and merchandising is going up. But does that necessarily have to be the way that we go forward? And we've been really interested, as we've talked to people in preparing for this event, about hearing people's perspectives on that, about how it's obviously a very different lifestyle choice for a musician to make the decision to be a professional musician these days than it may have been a couple of years ago. Not better, not worse, but just it's a very different thing. You have to spend a lot more energy if you're going to be one of these musicians who is downplaying the importance of the value of the recordings and increasing reliance on touring and other merchandising. You have to spend a lot more of your time doing fan outreach and being on the road touring and doing all these sorts of things. We have this conception in this conference of these sort of three buckets of issues. The sort of tagline for the conference is it's about creativity, commerce, and policy. But I think Alan's exactly right. You can't really neatly segment things like that. And there's such interaction, interplay between the legal regime that we live in today and the way that business models can get structured.
And it seems artists have a lot of different options to them when they are looking into, you know, both how they want to make money and how they want to treat, you know, their content. They can just our podcast itself. It's a Creative Commons licensed podcast. We use a lot of Creative Commons music. I don't know how the artists who do those licenses make their money, but they keep making music. So I imagine that they have some sort of way of supporting themselves. But there's other ways too. I mean, there's a big project I just heard of where an artist is putting together an orchestra to record all of the out of copyright great orchestral works and then put those orchestral works under public domain so anybody can use them. And that is receiving a lot of funding through independent supporters. Talk a little bit about the licensing issues and, you know, how people are, you know, creatively licensing their content.
Well, you hit on the notion of Creative Commons licenses, so that there is a new model out there that, again, it ties into our existing policy framework in the U.S. Sort of the Creative Commons model does not represent a change in copyright law. It says, given copyright law as it exists today, here are some license agreements that sort of work within that structure. So typically, if I, to make things easy, write a song and then record a song, so I own all the interest in the musical composition, the sort of notes and rhythm and lyrics that are part of the song, and I own all the interest in the sound recording, just to make it easy, and you want to come to me and use that for some reason, you want to put it in a film, or you want to maybe put it on a compilation album, you typically have to come to me to get permission to use the composition and the sound recording. There are some situations in which using the composition, you don't need to get my permission, that the law actually allows you to use it as long as you pay me a royalty without actually having to technically talk to me and negotiate a license. But effectively, you need to get a license from me to use both the composition and the sound recording. What Creative Commons does is it allows, it sort of eases that process. It greases the wheels. It basically says, it allows me to put my works out there and say, I'm comfortable with people using these works on the following terms and assign terms to them. It works with musical works. It also works with photographs. It works with all sorts of creative content. If I take a photograph and put it up on Flickr and I assign a Creative Commons license to it, I may tell the world you're allowed to use it as long as you do the following. And typically it means you give me attribution. You give me credit for doing it. Typically, you're right. Money doesn't change hands. Creative Commons licenses do not have a monetary component to them. And to the extent an artist is using them, like you said, that artist is presumably making money in another way, or seeing, you know, indirect monetary benefits arising out of its use of Creative Commons licenses, getting its works out there, getting its name out there, as Alan said before, maybe touring, maybe doing something else to kind of bring in money, maybe selling other recordings. Maybe I'll put a handful of my recordings out there under Creative Commons and others I'll sell.
And what other sorts of challenges are artists facing with the public policy or the policy itself? What kinds of proposals are you expecting to see people submit to this competition?
one of the couple of things I've heard is when talking to people is whether there might be ways to implement what have been called in other places in the world alternative compensation system. These are systems that essentially require people to pay fees as part of their internet access, and those fees go to content owners, and those fees essentially offset the fact that the internet access is being used, as we know, to download or download people's musical work. So it's essentially a system to compensate content owners, again, almost as a tax on top of people's internet services. I don't know if we'll see a proposal like that here, but that's the kind of thing we've heard about. There's a whole other set of proposals. I think that there in general are a set of proposals out there to facilitate licensing, to make licensing easier. I think that one complaint you often hear from people who need to or want to use other people's musical works is, even if I wanted to get to license this, I wouldn't have the foggiest idea how to go about doing it. I don't know who owns it. I don't know how much it costs me to do it. There are all sorts of legal obstacles out there to creating large collective licensing organizations for certain kinds of musical works. And I imagine that we're going to see some people talking about whether we can create registries or databases of works or easier licensing mechanisms by law to allow people to use other people's musical works.
Technology is playing a big role, not just in how music is distributed or how, you know, consumers are accessing music legally or illegally, but in achieving some of these solutions. And it sounds like that's something that's going to be focused on a little bit at this conference. And I've heard of some really, really interesting ways that folks have created new kinds of software and iPhone apps and things like that that take advantage of music. I mean, Pandora is just one. And then it seems to be a ton of others. Have you seen that as something that's actually making a difference in the music industry?
I think that there are a number of other sort of access models. So Chris talked a little bit about alternative compensation schemes in other countries and tax on internet service rates. But I think that there are, some questions around blanket licensing and questions around, you know, wholesale access to content. Pandora is actually a Digital Millennium Copyright Act compliant radio station, and they operate under the license fees that are paid by DMCA compliant radio. But other services like Rhapsody, Spotify, and other iPhone apps and other kind of content access related software technology is built on the concept of pay a flat fee, get all you can eat access. Maybe you can download it. Maybe it's all in the cloud, in the proverbial cloud. But I think that people for years have now been saying that this is the next step, this access model. We just haven't yet seen it take hold, and I think it'll be interesting to have some thought around that at this event as to, is that the future, and if it is, why haven't we been able to facilitate it taking hold? Because it's not a new idea that popped out of the sky 6 months ago.
But it is something that has developed. In part, at least I'm thinking of Pandora, by the inspiration of the creator, not through any other kind of incentive. And in fact, I believe Pandora in the early stages faced a lot of challenges legally and financially with making themselves compliant with the DMCA. And that brings in the aspect of the industry and how the recorded music industry has evolved and learned to exist in this new paradigm. How do you perceive the industry's role?
I think it's another one where it keeps saying is it depends on who you ask, but you're definitely you're going to hear the perception from content owners, I think, that they need to play a role in screening and helping to determine who are going to be the next really viable music services that are going to provide content to listeners. Who are the ones that we should? Who are the horses we should bet on? Who are the ones that we should nurture and provide our content to and really support? And who are going to be the sort of the next big saviors of the industry? And you're going to hear other people who are going to say, content owners, that's not really the decision for you to make. Why don't you license your content to anyone and everyone? And the biggest, baddest, best business models will win out because customers will gravitate toward things that work well for them, whether it's iTunes or whether it's Pandora or perhaps Spotify if and when they ever launch in the US. But, you know, when people will find the ones they like and they will use them, but the content owners shouldn't be playing a role in that process. They shouldn't be picking winners. They should be basically out there making the content available, you know, in exchange for compensation, but making the content available to a wide range of players and letting the marketplace sort it out.
You're listening to Radio Berkman. I'm Daniel Dennis Jones. This spring, the Berklee College of Music and MIDEM, along with the Berkman Center, are hosting the Rethink Music Conference in Boston, an opportunity for artists, innovators, industry, academics, and others to discuss where music as an industry has come from and where it's going. Alan Bargfried of Berklee and Chris Babbitts of the Berkman Center sat down with me to talk about what success means for the modern musical act.
What do artists see as the key, I mean, the success? Like, it used to be, you know, signing up with a label. When you got signed, that would be, you know, when you got your ticket. Either that or you're selling out or something like that. There used to be a very clear definition of that.
I think that has certainly changed from an artist's perspective. You know, there used to be a day when you could be a songwriter playing in a coffee shop and an A&R exec could walk in and say, I'm going to give you a record deal and I'm going to make you a star. And those days are just pretty much, for the most part, gone. So an artist that wants to be signed to a label is going to have done some work to have developed a following on their own. And so artists right now either have to have a really good manager who likes to do that type of stuff, or they need to be internet savvy and they need to be involving and engaging their fans so that a label sees that they have an existing fan base. I think one of the arguments that Chris and I have heard as well is what is the role of a major label right now? I think that there still has not been an act that really broke through and became an amazing headlining act at large venues around the country or around the world without a major label. So I think the labels still very much have a role to play, but the days of the artist kind of holding out for their record deal are pretty much gone.
And you've got new artists who aren't even playing at the coffee shop anymore. You have Justin Bieber, who, you know, played in his Canadian home just in front of YouTube. Mm-hmm. And in that way, you could say, you know, did Justin Bieber need to sign with a label? Would he have been able to achieve success on his own through, you know, getting his music out to his fans through YouTube and then finding, you know, selling his stuff through with PayPal or something like that?
Yeah, these are exactly the kinds of examples, sort of case studies, if you will, that we really hope we're going to take a good hard look at the event and maybe even in the lead up to the event, is to see, you know, this exact question. You know, you have an artist who comes to some point in their career. Maybe it's a very early point. Maybe they're just making YouTube videos in their bedroom. Maybe it's a little bit later on. Maybe they're actually playing small clubs, or maybe if it's even further on, they've been on a major label and they're nearing the end of their major label contract, and we see them reaching these decision points. What do I do? Do I re-sign with this big label? Do I sign with a label at all? Do I just set up a tip jar on my website and say, give me money if you like it, and I'm just going to make everything available for free? Do I offer my recordings through my website through some sort of a tiered system? So if you want to just buy my 11 MP3s from my new album, you just pay me $5. But if you want to get a signed copy of the album, it's a little more. And if you want a poster, it's on top of that. And if you want a t-shirt, if you want to come over to my house and I'll perform the songs for you in an intimate setting, then that's, you know, $10,000. These are all different types of things we're seeing. And I think that one of the values of doing this with in something of an academic setting with academics involved is I hope we're going to see some empirical research coming out of this. I think it's going to be great, you know, having folks from the business school and the law school involved, thinking a little bit about these issues, getting a sense of what works, getting a sense of what works for whom. Are there different types of models that work for different types of artists? Justin Bieber is a very different kind of artist than Arcade Fire, who did play Madison Square Garden this year, having never actually been on a major label. You know, so there are, you know, obviously they've both achieved success in different senses. It's going to be really interesting, I think, to see, to put a little bit of research behind that.
Talk about some of the artists you expect to participate. I don't know if you're allowed to, or you have, you know, a definitive starting list yet, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the participants who are.
I think it's, or I'm not sure if we have participants artists wise actually firmly confirmed at this point.
We have a number. We're in discussions with a number of high level artists. How's that?
But I think that the goal as we've conceived of it is that it's really important to get people from all stages, from all these different types of corners of the business and all different stages of their career. So in an ideal world, I hope and I expect we're going to be talking to some very high level major artists and some more recent artists kind of at earlier stages in their career and everywhere in between. I mean, I think that in some of our early discussions with people, it really bore out what Alan said at the beginning, is that these events happen in the music industry all the time. There are lots of these conferences. A lot of them are really good, and a lot of participants are fantastic, really brilliant people who think about these issues critically. But I think that some of the more interesting stuff I hope we're going to hear from participants in this conference is going to come from creators and people at sort of the ground level about, you know, we really want them to have a voice in this conversation. And it's one thing to hear CEOs of digital music companies and record companies and publishers and all the way down the line talking about the future of the music business model. But I think it's going to be really important to talk to people who are saying, hey, I'm an artist now, and I used to be able to write songs for 5 hours a day, and now I wake up in the morning and I update my Twitter account five hours a day. You know, that's, again, maybe great, maybe works really well, maybe it doesn't. I think it's going to be interesting to hear those stories.
I did want to provoke a little bit more on the industry side of things, because the fair side of me, the referee inside of me, feels that industry and the big business and the label, they get the short end of the argument, because they it's easy to label them as, you know, the kind of selfish, kind of Ebenezer Scrooge-ish, you know, and guarding a piece of territory that is obsolete now. I'm not sure if that's a rational way to view the industry. Do they still play a role? Are they still important to this discussion?
Well, I think, as Chris said, it depends on who you talk to. But I think that, labels still very much have a role to play. And there's been a lot of discussion about whether they are, whether they're a dying breed, whether they've been slow to adapt. I think just as a whole with this conference, I've been to a number of these things over the past 2 or 3 years, and a guy made an astute comment at the San Francisco Music Tech Summit last year that most of these industry events result in the music industry circling the wagons and shooting inward rather than outward. I think that sort of lending ourselves back to the idea of this being a solutions-oriented event, we want to circle the wagons and figure out, how do we really help the artist? And how do we help the labels? Because the labels do have a role to play in helping the artist. And so how do we facilitate things for everyone? I think one of the discussion points, and we haven't really talked much about the things that we'll talk about at the actual event, but one of the discussion points is working together to create a bigger pie rather than fighting over pieces of a shrinking pie.
I also think on the policy side, I'm someone who worked for a large record label for a lot of years, so maybe I have a skewed view on it. But I think that when you hear policy proposals that emerge out of people's vitriol and hatred of record labels, you can sometimes forget that if you step back, the labels are in some ways proxies for the creators. We can talk about whether the labels deals with the creators are fair and just, and whether they should be adjusted in some way, and whether new models should result. But if you're going to make decisions about changes in copyright law because you think that labels are, like you said, the Ebenezer Scrooges of the world, you are at the end of the day, I think in some ways, at least you run the risk of hurting creators at the end of the day, and I don't think that's something that most people want to do. And so I just think that's something that people should keep in mind as they think about these issues. And one of the kind of the hallmarks of our policy proposal competition is that we are asking people to not simply identify a problem and explain how they would fix it, but explain how that fix would affect the various stakeholders with an interest in these issues. So if your policy proposal competition is just, let's abolish copyright law, there should be no copyright law, does that, maybe that's a viable proposal, but let's have you explain how that is going to impact the various stakeholders. Is that going to incentivize the creation of new works and the building of musical repertoire and that sort of thing. Maybe it will, but maybe not. That's something that we want people to build into these policy proposal suggestions.
So we've talked about the two competitions, and we've talked about some of the we've touched on some of the issues that are going to be talked about. I wonder if there were some other areas that we haven't talked about yet that some of the panels will be covering.
You know, I think that one group that Chris didn't mention when we were talking about involving people is or two groups really are artist managers, because I think that they play an interesting role right now. If labels are sort of going away or taking a smaller role, the manager is really taking a larger role. And so some of this stuff that's done to develop the fan base early on that gets the attention of the large label is done now by the manager. Unless you have an artist who really is diligent about waking up in the morning and spending 5 hours on Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and promoting themselves. And then I think there will also be some discussions from venture capitalists. So how do they see the industry? There have been something like 120 VC-funded new music business model startups over the past 10 years, and I believe only 5 are profitable right now. And so they'll be actively involved engaging the business and judging the business model competition. But
those 5 that are successful, or
the VCs.
Oh, the VC. Okay.
but also we want to have some input from them at the actual event about how do they see the industry, how do they perceive the industry, what business model or policy change would make this an industry that's attractive to invest in.
Yeah, I think those are two great examples. Yeah. And I think the other one I would add to that group, in addition to artist managers and VCs, is some of the technologists. I think that people who are actually building cool, interesting apps that let you access music. So we can talk about what model we need to put in place, whether through policy changes or through new business models, to compensate creators for use of the content, but delivering the content to people in ways that is interesting, innovative, fun, via a weird, cool iPhone app or some other sort of piece of software or a web-based application, I think is key. I think that you look at the ones that have been successful, and you can see there are a couple examples of ones out there that have approached this in an innovative way. And I think we're going to see a lot more, especially with mobile devices and that sort of things, ways to get the content to people in ways that are really interesting and fun.
Well, it seems like a really fun topic. It seems like everything that you guys are talking about, and the stakes are high, but the way you guys are framing them seems really fun, and it seems really inspired. Will you get everybody together in the room, and will they just be playing nicely?
We're hoping that's the case. I think that there have been a number of events over the past few years too, where you've seen some heads really butt and some real arguments take place on panels, and some of the time those are constructive arguments, and they're arguments that need to be aired. But I think at Berkeley, we are overwhelmingly excited to be working with Berkman. I think the combination of, the world's leading contemporary music conservatory with the Berkman Center and Harvard Business School is really an unbeatable combination.
And where can people go to find out more?
Check out www.rethink-music.com.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks for having us, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Alan Barkfried is Assistant Professor of Music Business at Berklee College of Music and an attorney. Chris Babbitts is a Clinical Fellow at the Berkman Center and Assistant Director of the Cyber Law Clinic there. Find out more about next April's Rethink Music Conference at their site, rethink-music.com, or head on over to our blog at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. We'll have links to more information on the conference and the two competitions. If you haven't already, you can also subscribe to the podcast at our website, and you might want to. This episode is part of our Rethinking Music series, so between now and April and the coming months, you can expect to see interviews with some amazing artists, app developers, innovators, folks in the business community, all of whom are doing some incredible work in music. So go on over to our website to check that out. This week's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with special thanks this week to Amr Asher, Alan Barkfried, and Chris Babbitts at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.